Blog Talk Radio.
I wasn't sure if the music was going to kick in there or not, but you know, we have to start with some music to get the vibe going for our 10 p.m. broadcast. That's right. Folks, you're listening to the Duke Machado Show. My name is Duke Machado. If you're tuned in tonight, it's because you're really one of those people trying to figure out what's going on in the Middle East. And we have a very special guest. He's you know, on the program, we've had him on here at least 3-4 times now, and enjoy every one of the programs. We were just talking earlier with Dr. David Walalu. He is professor of government at McLennan Community College. He's a former U.S. Army intelligence guy. He's got Homeland Security background, you name it. His ear is to the ground when it comes to the Middle East. And this program tonight is part one of a two-part series. We'll just call it a two-part segment here. In this segment, I asked him to break down all of the different players, all the different elements in the Middle East, and how they correlate with each other. Why are some enemies? Why are some collaborating? Why do some nations work together? Why do they all, not all, but it seems like there's just turmoil. And so this program tonight, we're going to hear from him, and he's going to hopefully give us some insight as to why things are going on. And then next Thursday, rather than just giving you a bunch of doom and gloom and calling it a day, next Thursday you're going to have to tune in again, because he's going to lay out some potential strategies, some ideas, some things that we as a nation, some thought processes that we might start considering. And so this is us again having a rational dialogue. It's easy to just want to hate all people from the Middle East, to fear all Muslims, all Arabs, all Palestinians, Jews. It's easy to just say, let's dismiss everything that's happening over there, because it's way over there. Here, we still go to the restaurants, and we still, you know, drive our cars and SUVs. There's really not a lot of problems here in our country, and so it seems distant. It seems like it doesn't really affect us. But boy, how I am wrong. Is that right?
That is correct. there's a lot of elements involved in the Middle East that we need to discuss. Well, first of all, I'm very delighted to be back here on your show. And as I said earlier in previous weeks, I certainly want to express my sincere appreciation to you for your efforts in truly bringing a serious issue to the forefront. And again, because that's what we need in this country. We need an honest debate. And as you suggested for the topic for this week about the Middle East, we will divide it into two segments, as you suggested. I will focus my today's talk about who the key players are and what are their motivations. Then on the following week, we'll talk about the strategies and so forth. So,
perfect.
Where do we start with the Middle East? Well, as 2015 unfolds, the Middle East continues to sort of implode, and with each new event, it suggests a greater threat to its people. And as we all witness, Syria is ravaged by a civil war that no one can predict the outcome of. Iraq, on the other hand, is marred by sectarian violence. Yemen is thrown into chaos. And add to those the political and security instability in Egypt, the emergence of ISIS, a failed state in Libya, And what you get basically is a Middle East, a volatile stew of conflicting passions and ideologies. How do you sort all this out? Well, to understand all these dynamics, one must have an understanding of the historical transformation of the societies within the Middle East. And today, we're going to focus on three key players. Basically, there are six, but I will focus on three because those three are playing a major role in the political landscape in the Middle East. First comes Saudi Arabia, second, Iran, and third is Turkey. The other three elements, they are Libya, Jordan, and Egypt. And why I'm not going to focus too much on Libya, Jordan, and Egypt, not only because the instability, the security instability, the economic downturn in those countries, but also because those countries do not play as great a role as, let's say, Saudi Arabia or Iran or Turkey. For Saudi Arabia, for example, if we are to look at the Middle East, you cannot picture the Middle East without Saudi Arabia. And why is that? It's not only it's the site to the two most holy sites in the Muslim world, Mecca and Medina, also because Saudi Arabia is the world oil producer, which means it can dictate what the oil prices on the world market is going to be. On the other hand, Saudi Arabia also is the highest purchaser of American weaponry. So we usually have a tendency when our unemployment goes up, all the Saudis need to do is write a check for $60 billion, and here it is. Our unemployment goes down because they purchase all the weapons that they need. But the recent dynamics in the Middle East, especially the religious aspect, is between the Shia and the Sunni. The Shia, the dominant one in Iran, and the Sunni, of course, represented by in Saudi Arabia. And this stems from, as we all know, as your listeners know, it stems from the Iran nuclear deal that was struck in July between Iran and the West, including the U.S. That certainly has struck a chord with the Saudis because the fear that if Iran could acquire a nuclear technology, then they're going to spread their wings, which means on a religious aspect, and there is one thing Saudis won't want to relinquish. It's their religious leadership in the Muslim world. And that creates some sort of hidden tensions, first, religiously speaking, that now have emerged to the forefront. You look at Syria, what's going on there? You look at Libya, what's going on there? And you look at Yemen, what's going on there? But let's take just the example of Syria and Yemen. These two, because both Saudi Arabia and Iran have proxies in those two countries, but they are fighting in support of each entity. Saudis, for example, in Yemen are fighting against Houthis, and Houthis, which is a Shia group, basically, that is supported by Iran. The same dynamics or same scenario is occurring in Syria. Well, of course, with Syria, it's a little bit more complicated because you have too many groups to the point for us in the U.S., we have no idea who's who. It's almost we can't trust who we're going to support. And it just happened with the Pentagon last month, I believe. There was a report that stated that the Pentagon ended up not knowing who the group that they were training because that group turned around and provided all the weaponry. We provide that group to al-Nusra group. Well, al-Nusra group is an affiliate of al-Qaeda. Saudis claim that for it to be peace and stability in Syria, al-Assad has to be removed from power. Iran, on the other hand, saying you cannot find a solution to the Syrian conflict without Assad being in power. So you can just see the dynamics that there is no end in sight. It's too complicated. Then
okay,
you have
so
this. Yeah, go ahead.
If I could ask a quick question here, it seems to me the thing that you said that really stands out is that you say Saudi Arabia does not want to relinquish their religious leadership. But what is
right.
it about the Saudi religious leadership that's so different from the Shia?
Well, first of all, because to Saudis, the religious leadership is the only currency they have. I mean, how else would you know about Saudi Arabia except beyond being the country where Islam was born, where the two holy sites in the Muslim world are residing in Saudi Arabia. They exist in Saudi Arabia, Mecca and Medina. And so to the point that the Saudis claim that authority, that they are the one in charge of all Muslims, which, by the way, when you go around the Muslim world, they don't share the same views. Not everybody sees the Saudis in the same light. They view Saudi Arabia as a corrupt monarchy.
A tyrant, almost.
Yeah. There is no love there for the Saudis around the Muslim world. I mean, just the human rights abuses that's going on, and the big issue with us here in the U.S. is we turn the blind eye on stuff like that, which usually you can't do that when you claim to be a beacon of democracy. You can't be turning your blind eye on abuses that are occurring there, whatever those abuses are. We just can't do that. It's because we depend on their oil. We depend on their petrodollars, per se. And yet, at the same time, the Saudis are the ones financing madrasas in Pakistan, the ones are financing the Wahhabism, the radicalism, and so forth. It has to have a mechanism by which those groups are supported financially. I wrote two articles, one on the Waco Tribe and one on a Huffington Post addressing this particular issue. And I was very, very surprised and overwhelmed by the comments that I read on, especially the one on the Huffington Post.
Mm-hmm.
People were very interested in wanting to learn more about why these kind of issues are not addressed. And this is where I see the role of your show. Here is your show now that bringing issues that we don't hear much about. We hear it about from, let's say, a retired general who worked as an analyst for CNN or Fox or what have you. But you don't hear the real issues, how they are impacting others in the different parts of the, not only the Muslim world, but the West as well. When you hear the statement as, well, we don't like Christians, says who? In Islam, there is no such thing. But because you have certain radicals that are supported by the government, they have the authority and the freedom to issue statements like that. And this is where part of the...
Would you say that the Saudi Arabian government is a radical government because they support these groups?
Well, I would say so, because I'm sure you've read about the WikiLeaks documents that have been released a year ago or so. And one of them, actually, was on an article on New York Times. And I documented that in my own article, because as a reference, in the New York Times, it was a quote there that back then, the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, issued a memo that the Saudis have to stop the funding to terrorism. Mm-hmm. I mean, why are we sugarcoating the truth for what it is? Let's just state it the way it is and let the American people understand where the issues are.
It's because they have us by the around the juggler. they're such a force with their economic power, their oil.
That is correct.
They manipulate us.
That is correct. When you have a country that has about $6 trillion in reserves here in the U.S., you can see why they will dictate to us what to do and not to do in the Middle East. And that's usually
we're going around and we're in Afghanistan. I don't know who we're attacking, who we're going after. I don't know that we even know who our enemy really is.
No, we don't. It's because those elements are funded and supported by forces outside Afghanistan and Pakistan. I mean, those are the dynamics. That's how it works. I mean, when you look at the Taliban, for example, the emergence of Taliban back in the 80s, How the Taliban came about? It was nothing but a fight between Iran Shia and Sunni Wahhabism in Saudi Arabia. And of course, Saudi Arabia threw so much money that was the big help for the Taliban that helped them emerge into the leadership and took over the country. So those are issues that have to be addressed head on, and it has to be not sugar-coated per se, but stated the way they are. Then now, if I may just shift the conversation here a little bit to
sure.
the nuclear issue with Iran, because where I see the challenges, and we will talk about this next week as far as the strategy for the U.S., how the United States needs to have a strategy in place. Basically, our problem now is we have an ambiguous policy. We have an ambiguous foreign policy towards the Middle East. And that is what the subject of my upcoming book about, because I wanted to lay out the argument to why this ambiguity exists to begin with. So now with the Iran, the nuclear deal has been reached with the West, and of course with the lifting of the sanctions soon to be from the U.S. and the U.N. Because what American people need to understand, the U.S. is not the only country that has sanctions on Iran. There are three entities. There's Europe, there's the U.N., and there's the U.S. So Europeans are already preparing the groundwork now to lift the sanctions on Iran. As a matter of fact, Switzerland, for example, is already lining up the deals with Iran. Germany has already sent a delegation to Iran. France has sent a delegation to Iran as well. They're already laying out the groundwork for business interests. And once Iran, once the sanctions lifted by the U.S., and they would have access to their billions and billions of dollars, I am certain you will see a major, if not already, a shift in the geopolitical landscape of the Middle East. And that's when you're going to see the true confrontation between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And for us in the U.S., we need to understand we cannot be surrounded by hostile forces. It's almost like what happened back in 1982 in Lebanon. When we were in Beirut, we were surrounded by hostile forces. We didn't understand the dynamics till we get our barracks bombed and 268 Marines lost their lives. We have to have a strategy on how to deal with these upcoming changes in the Middle East. And you will agree with me now with what Russia is doing in Syria is certainly giving a heads up to what might be coming down the road. And we need to prepare for these eventualities and understand that we need to have a strategy in place to address this force-producing dynamics in the Middle East. Then you add to all these dynamics, you add Turkey. Well, Turkey now will be claimed to be attacking, conducting air strikes on ISIS. Basically, they weren't attacking ISIS. They were attacking the Kurds because Turkey cares less about ISIS. Turkey cares more about the Kurds. They don't want the Kurds to have their own sovereign state. And this is why we, the United States, it's most likely we will never recognize Kurdistan as an independent entity or an independent state because we won't want to upset the Turks. Why? Because Turkey is in a strategic location that is of great strategic importance to us, to NATO. And we certainly don't want to see that change. We don't want to change that, those dynamics. We want to maintain everything the way it is. Now, with all this being said, you bring ISIS to the picture. And my argument has always been this. You're telling me that a force of 30,000 terrorists that we couldn't control that at the beginning. Now, there are more than 30,000, by the way. And most intelligence services around in the West are unable to identify the exact numbers because ISIS is growing faster than you can imagine. And we couldn't control that. And why is that? Because that falls back to the beginning of the Syrian civil war. The big problem that I noticed back then, and I still notice it today, is when we started to issue warnings, red lines, if you will, to countries, but we don't back that up with deeds. Basically, what we end up doing is telling the countries, hey, we are all about talks, but no action. We told the Syrians, there is a red line when it comes down to chemical weapons. If you use weapons, you'll be crossing the red lines. And yet, when Syrians, Bashar al-Assad used chemical weapons, we didn't do anything. So that sends a message to the rest of the world that, oh, America now only talks. America cannot act. Countries pick on this stuff. Countries are not dumb. They are not stupid. They can read between the lines. And when you are the superpower and you don't back your words, you don't follow through, these countries realize you don't have any more credibility. And that is exactly what we're noticing now in the Middle East. Most countries now, thanks over the U.S., hey, U.S. has no credibility whatsoever. And look at the Russians, how they behave. The Russians consulted with us as far as airstrikes only 1 hour before they start conducting their sorties.
Yeah, well, I would say that, I mean, it, not to turn this into just a straight slam on our president, but to me it seems like he went around when he first was elected and visited many of these countries and these leaders. Now, who knows what was said, but it must have been something along the lines of, I tell you what, I'm going to stay out of this. You all try to work things out and try not to get us involved too much. Because it kind of seems like, you know, of course, his election promise was to end the wars, et cetera, et cetera. But really, surely he had to know that this war is not going to end by pulling troops out. Do you think... Do you think that, you know, we can just be nice to them and everything's going to be all right?
No, there is a theory in international relations. In international relations, context matters. Context matters. And this is exactly what's happening. When you are a superpower, it is expected of you to lead. Do we want China or Russia in the Middle East? I am certain if you ask foreign policy experts, they'll be shaking their heads. And this is exactly what we're seeing. I'm writing an article right now, probably will appear sometime in the next few days, about the role of China is going to be playing given the latest visit by the top admiral, the Chinese admiral, to Iran. And to me, those are the signs. Those are the writings on the wall. We're moving in to the Middle East. Why? Because countries already start to realize the U.S. has no more credibility. There is no more leadership. Because we're saying one thing and doing another.
But what does China have to gain? I mean, what does China have to gain from all of this?
Well, there are three elements to that. There's economic benefits, military apparatus, and strategic. On the economic front, remember, Iran is the top supplier of oil to China. And for China to maintain its economic machine moving forward, they're going to need a lot of energy, and that energy, the sources of energy, are from the Middle East. Because China also signed a deal with Saudi Arabia. So between these two countries, and remember, Iran is the third oil producer in the world. And here is another thing for you to realize the dynamics, how complicated it is. Why do you think Iran is in Iraq? There are oil fields that have not been explored yet in the south, which basically give them a straight access to the Strait of Hormuz, which once Iran takes over this field, that becomes Iranian oil. And can you just imagine with access to all that oil, China wouldn't want to miss the opportunity, given that it was China, in addition to Russia, that have pushed forward for the nuclear deal between Iran and the West. So it's payback time. On the military front, I would not be surprised, as I argued 3 months ago, during one of my presentations at Fort Hood in front of some generals there, that I won't be surprised that it would be just a matter of time before China and Iran enters into some strategic treaty in which Tehran or Iran would allow China to establish a military or naval base either on Iranian territory, which is of a great geostrategic importance, or it will be near the Strait of Hormuz, which is also a strategic one because that's considered one of the main waterways for the global oil shipments. So it will be just a matter of time. On the strategic side, China's looking at it far down the road. China's thinking is, I better keep the U.S. busy in the Middle East so they will forget about the Asian Pacific realm. And I am certain you heard about China's expanding its sphere of influence and mobilizing its forces into the South China Sea islands. And as a matter of fact, they even issued a threat to the U.S. that should the U.S. move its ships over there, they might have to retaliate militarily. So you can just see the dynamics to why China and Russia are moving over there. But the big picture in all this, those countries are benefiting from the chaos that's going on in the Middle East because it created a platform for them to challenge U.S. leadership. And at the same time, we are not doing anything because we don't have a strategy in place. We don't have a strategy. We don't have vision. We don't have our foreign policy, just like it's ambiguous. And we all know that the problems of the Middle East didn't happen overnight. And even our involvement did not occur overnight. And I am certain finding a solution to the ongoing turmoil in the Middle East will take time, will need patience, and will take vision and a systematic strategy for it to happen.
Let me ask you a couple of questions. We've only got about 3 minutes left, and it's another one of those shows that just flew by.
I know.
To me, it seems like if you shake off if you shake everything off and dust everything off, and you know, you're left with Saudi versus Iran.
That's
it
correct.
Seems to me like it's also, so that's Sunni versus Shia. It's a battle for religious domination and of the Muslim world.
That is correct.
And then on top of that, you add that you've got these other nations that are coming in with big money. Heck, the United States is coming in with big money. We're going to help them develop heavy water that they can sell around the world.
That is correct. And add to all this, add ISIS. ISIS, which called itself as the Khalifa of the Islamic Ummah, which is completely, it's stupidity anyway. But ISIS at the same time is a unique Islamic political force with a political goal. The only difference is that political objective or goal is wrapped into a religious narrative. That's how they sell that to the Muslim world. So add all those dynamics to the Shia versus Sunni, and you can just see a fireball in the Middle East that even God himself might not be able to stop. So you can just see how the dynamics are. And for us in the U.S., if we don't understand the ins and outs of what those dynamics are all about, we won't be able to come up with a very systematic and methodical strategy that will help us find our way into this complex.
Well, that's the purpose of our show next Thursday. we've got to find our way through it. We've got to thread the needle. Whatever challenge it is, our future president and administration will have to deal with it. We're going to have to get behind a plan, and at least we're talking about it and getting this out in the open. I do appreciate you again for joining me tonight. All the listeners, I appreciate you tuning in. Sorry we didn't take any calls tonight. We did have a few that were on hold, but in the next few weeks we'll get the calls going again. Until then, find me on Facebook and like my page, The Duke Machado Show, and on Twitter, at Duke Machado 1. And be looking forward to our program next Thursday with Dr. David Owalalu. We're out of here.